It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin residents are experiencing another round of extreme heat this week.
The National Weather Service's heat risk map shows almost the entire state under a red 3 risk with major heat-related impacts. That includes health risks for heat-sensitive populations and people who are working outside.
In just a bit, we'll hear from Madison's emergency management coordinator about preparations to help keep residents cool.
But first, a look at this sprawling heat dome situated over the Midwest and how it will affect life in Wisconsin this week. For that, we have meteorologist Kevin Wagner from the National Weather Service Milwaukee Sullivan office for an update. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This heat risk map showing almost the entire state at high heat risk for multiple days. What can our state expect in this week's heat wave?
Yeah, so today we're expecting temperatures in the mid-90s to even upper 90s. Can't even rule out a couple places hitting that 100-degree mark. And that's just the temperature. But we're also in the midst of summer, so we got the humidity as well. So it's kind of muggy out there. So the mugginess and the heat combined is going to give us a feel-like temperature of over 100 across much of the state. And that's why we have the higher heat risk, as well as we have heat advisories for much of the state. And in the far northwestern part of the state, we have extreme heat warnings for those conditions as well.
This has been dragging on multiple days. Can you explain what a heat dome is?
Yes. So we have the upper level jet is kind of way up to the north, up in Canada right now. And that's really what's driving like the winds and stuff up there. But we're kind of hanging below that. So we're not getting the pattern to kind of shift through. So that's allowing the warm temperatures from the south to kind of build up all the way into the upper Great Lakes area. And with the jet kind of remaining further north, the pattern's not really moving. It's just kind of sitting stationary for several days. So yesterday we saw some high temps to, and again, we're going to see them today and going to even linger into tomorrow and possibly even into Thursday. So the pattern's just kind of sitting over us. It's able to build those heat. And the extended period of seeing these warmer temperature or these hotter temperatures are also results in those higher heat risk concerns, because it's just kind of not much relief in between the days. But thankfully this weekend, it does look like things will start to move. We start to get the jet kind of starts to shift back south and our pattern becomes more progressive. We can get a little bit of cool down.
That's what I was wondering. How does a heat dome ultimately push out or break up?
Essentially, yeah, we get the jet that comes back down, brings in a low pressure system. So we kind of get the pattern to start flowing again, because the atmosphere is a fluid. So we kind of have to get that, kick it into gear again. So usually a storm system, we are expecting kind of a low pressure to kind of work its way across Wisconsin later Friday into Saturday. That's going to drag a cold front. And then that colder air mass is able to make its way back down and kind of provide some relief for us.
Will overnight lows provide any relief as we move through this heat wave?
Yeah, it was not going to be as bad as we saw at the end of June. With that stretch of heat, we really saw those higher temperatures in the upper 70s with those muggy conditions. We're still see some of those areas that we see low 70 temperatures overnight, but we still get those 60s as well. So there is some relief overnight. I know I took a walk this morning at 5 a.m. It was muggy, but it was at least comfortable to walk outside.
That's a good time to be walking, indeed. This isn't the first wave of extreme heat in Wisconsin, Kevin. Can we expect more as we head into August? What is long range looking like?
So this is typical time of year, July, end of July into August. This is our hottest part of the year. Our average high temperatures are at their peak this time of year. But as we're kind of move into August, mid to late August, we slowly start to see those temperatures start to fall. But looking at the extended 2 weeks out, you know, the general trend, we're kind of going to trend back towards normal based on the pattern. Doesn't mean we can't get a hot day here and there. It's just overall we're going to kind of trend towards those normal temperatures, which around here is low 80s for high temperatures and then the mid 60s for overnight lows.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That is meteorologist Kevin Wagner from the National Weather Service Milwaukee Sullivan office. We're talking about another wave of extreme heat that's bearing down on Wisconsin. Now for a look at coordination efforts to keep people cool, we turn to the city of Madison, where emergency management coordinator Colton Ritchie is working with organizations around the region on emergency preparedness and response. Colton, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
What are some of the things that you're focusing on to keep Madison and Dane County functioning safely through this heat wave?
Yeah, so in the short term, we're really focusing on, as you mentioned, some partnerships. We work with a lot of our nonprofit partners to make sure there's places people can go in the heat, make sure that they're prepared and able to take people in, and also our city agencies, such as our libraries and community centers. There are already places that people can go, so we want to make sure that they're ready and operating normally. For long term, we're working with couple people around the city. For example, our Office of Sustainability and Resilience is doing a lot of work to reduce heat islands. We're also working with a statewide organization called the Heat Health Network. It's a group of emergency managers, public health professionals, and others who are looking at how we can do long-term actions to prepare communities and reduce the risk for individuals. And I think mostly what we're doing, though, is really doing messaging. We want to make sure that people know how to keep themselves safe, how to see the signs of heat-related illness, and know what they can do to stay prepared and stay cool in this extreme heat.
What are heat islands?
Yeah, so heat islands are areas that typically it's created by areas of more concrete and asphalt that traps heat during the day, also helps release it at night. So those areas that don't have a lot of tree cover tend to be up to 5 degrees hotter in places or in conditions like this. So we're really working to increase the tree cover to reduce that and also break up the how much concrete's in any given area.
You mentioned working with nonprofits and government agencies. How do you ready a building as a cooling center? What are some changes that are made?
Actually, very few. Cooling center is something that takes very little effort, so we are always happy to partner with any nonprofit who wants to just be listed on our website. We usually host that through public health or 211. But we really just want to make sure they have water available and a place for people to sit down, and they also need to have air conditioning because we want people to be able to cool down while they're in there and, you know, recover from the heat. But ultimately, it doesn't take a lot as long as we don't have power outages. In those cases, we're looking for places that have backup power, whether it be a generator or solar with batteries. And long term, we're looking to make more places resilient towards those power outages. But short term, very, very little changes are needed, just being willing to open your doors and let people come inside for a drink and a place to sit.
Are you monitoring the electrical grid in terms of whether there could be an outage or a brownout even?
We work with Madison Gas and Electric for the most part on that and Alliant Energy to make sure that there's no risk there. MG&E has assured us that right now their grid's maintaining full functionality and they don't anticipate any needs. That said, we maintain close contact with them as well as Dane County Emergency Management. So if we start to see issues, they typically let us know ahead of time if they can. If not, we react in the moment as well. But we do monitor that day to day, yes.
What can communities do to ensure people can access these cooling center buildings and that residents can still be able to carry on with the activities of daily life in a heat wave?
Yeah, so big thing that people can do to make sure people have access is what we try to do is put them on bus routes, places that are accessible, and put them widespread throughout the community. A few years back, we tried opening one at Alliant Energy Center. We learned that people can't come across the city just to cool down for a few minutes, right? So we want to make sure that they're throughout the community and available for people in their own neighborhoods. We also, like I said, prevention is really the biggest part of it. So as far as continuing their daily lives, we want people to hydrate ahead of time and do what they can and have a plan to know where they can go and cool down. Really, libraries in your community are a great place to go, as well as community centers. There's also quite a few museums around Madison that are free and a great place to cool down as well. So we really want to push that having a plan before the heat gets here.
Colton, people may not want to leave their pet or pets at home in these conditions. What can be done to help pets survive a heat wave?
Yeah, so biggest thing there is going to be, again, hydration is the big thing, right? So we want to make sure they have enough water and watch for any signs of illness there too. I'll admit that we're not where we want to be on pet accessible locations for cooling centers right now. We're working towards that, and it's kind of in our hopefully 5-year plan. But that said, there are restaurants around town that if you're able to go to a restaurant, that let people have pets there. There's also other public spaces. So knowing your neighborhood and knowing where your pets are welcome and where they can cool down is important. Also, if your pets likes to swim and they're safe to do so, you can find a place that they're able to go get in some water, typically along our beaches. Some of them are pet friendly. And then also same as us, right? They need shade. They need a place to cool down, and fans help them too. It helps their cooling system, their own body's cooling.
I want to pick up on the word resilience that you mentioned at the outset and this idea of individual resilience when preparing for extreme heat. how does individual resilience work?
Yeah, so for extreme heat in particular, and actually all emergencies, it largely comes down to make a plan. Right now, the plan, you know, is where am I going to go to cool down? What am I going to do if my air conditioner goes out? If I have air conditioning, do I have enough fans around the house? It's also knowing what resources are out there, right? So 2-in-1 is a great asset. So if you have issues with your power bills and you're choosing between whether or not you can turn on your air conditioner, giving 2-in-1 a call and finding out what programs are out there is a great way to go. For any other disaster, again, the plan's important, whether it be for a tornado or for a fire. Know what you're going to do, know where you're going to take shelter, and then also have an emergency kit. It's less important for slow-moving disasters like heat, but it's important still nonetheless, right? You don't want to be trying to figure out what you need to take with you if your power goes out and you're sitting there for a long period of time without heat. So you want to have that kit ready so that you can get out of your location quickly if you need to, and you know, makes it much easier if you're under stress.
The climate data showing that Wisconsin's hottest months are now getting hotter. Can you give an example? How are you factoring in the region's changing climate into your long-term plans for keeping Madison residents safe?
Yeah, so we're having to shift priorities a little bit. Heat events like this used to be much more rare, so mm-hmm. we didn't have to worry as much about cooling centers. So the big thing is making sure that these things are accessible. We're considering this when we're building out our community resilience hubs. We're kind of the same concept as those cooling centers. We want to make sure there's places people can go for any sort of emergency in their own community. So we want to make sure that these places also have air conditioning and ways to keep people cool, and are trained to recognize that people are, if they're having a heat-related illness and need emergency services. Aside from that, like I said, the city itself or at large is doing more planning to reduce the effects of heat. So increasing our tree cover, making sure parks are more accessible. We want to make sure that people know about splash pads. And this public information is a long-term plan because it takes a while for it to get out in the community and for people to become a second nature.
Really infiltrate in people's daily lives. Colton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Colton Ritchie is the City of Madison's Emergency Management Coordinator. We've been talking about another round of extreme heat hitting Wisconsin this week. And earlier, we spoke with National Weather Service meteorologist Kevin Wagner.
Coming up ahead of the August primary, Wisconsin's top election official has tips on how to make sure your ballot will be counted, especially when voting by mail.
The more time you can allow yourself, the better chance that that ballot is going to make it back in time to be counted.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. On August 11th, voters will decide their party's nominees for governor in the race to replace Democrat Tony Evers. They'll also decide who will run for the state's 8 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives, among other races.
To help you decide, WPR has just published its latest voter guide. You can find that at wpr.org/voter guide.
WPR's special projects reporter Bridget Bowden has been gathering the candidates' responses to a host of questions about their policies and beliefs. She talked with Wisconsin Today Morning News host Alex Crow.
One of the races that everyone is keenly focused on will be the race for governor. So can you tell us who exactly is in this race right now?
Yeah, so right now we have 5 Democrats running for governor. Those are Mandela Barnes, Joel Brennan, Francesca Hong, Kelda Royce, and Sarah Rodriguez. And on the Republican side, we have 2 candidates. Those are Tom Tiffany and Andy Mansky. And we sent survey questions to all of these candidates, and that is what you can find on our voter guide.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you how exactly this worked. You sent all of these questions out to the candidates, and then what? They just answer the questions, send it back to you, and it all kind of goes online for everyone to see?
Yeah, exactly. So we got these questions by actually asking our audience, What do you want the candidates to weigh in on as you decide who to vote for in this election? So we got over 100 responses from our audience members suggesting questions that they thought we should ask to the candidates. And there were definitely some topics that rose to the top that you could tell is really on voters' minds as they decide who to vote for. Specifically, education was something that people really want the governor candidates to weigh in on, drinking water, data centers in Wisconsin, and also how these candidates would work with the Trump administration if they were elected.
When we take a look at the House of Representatives, Bridget, nationally, there have been some races to redistrict, kind of determining the outcomes of some of these races before voters even head to the polls. Wisconsin is not one of them. So a lot of the races in Wisconsin are being more closely watched this year. Can you take us through some of those races that are being closely watched and what do voters want to know?
So for Wisconsin's congressional races, there are really only two seats that could potentially flip come the general election in November. Those are the first district, which is currently held by Republican Representative Brian Stile, and the third, which is currently Republican Representative Derek Van Orden's seat. So both of those incumbents are running. The Democrats are hopeful that their candidates will come out on top in November. We followed the same process for our voter guide for our congressional races. We asked people what they cared about, and then we sent those questions to the candidates. So if you go to our voter guide, you can see what candidates have said about data centers, about working with the Trump administration, about gas prices, about housing, all sorts of issues that people have told us they really care about.
Were there any sort of through lines when it came to the congressional races that kind of surprised you, or maybe any answers that people really specifically wanted to hear about? I know you mentioned a couple there.
One thing that rose to the top was, you know, how would you either work with the Trump administration or stand up to the Trump administration if you were elected to Congress? A lot of people told us that that's something they want to know from these candidates.
I want to take a wider look at the stakes for this upcoming governor's race. Tell me a little bit about that race and what's at stake there for the candidates.
Yeah, so with Democratic Governor Tony Evers stepping down, this is the first completely open governor's race we've seen in Wisconsin since 2010. And, you know, as we know, Wisconsin is a very purple state. So no matter who wins this primary in August, it's clear that the general election in November is going to be really close. So voters are definitely thinking a few months down the line as they decide who they're going to vote for in August. And hopefully our voter guide can help people make that decision.
Our colleagues over with Inside Wisconsin Politics will keep you up to date there as well. WPR's Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden, thank you so much for joining us and helping us break down this voter guide that's now available. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
To learn more about WPR's online voter guide, go to WPR.org/voter guide.
Now we'll hear from Wisconsin's top election official about our state's voting process and what voters need to know before heading to the polls for the August 11th partisan primary.
Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. WPR host Brady Carlson spoke with her last week.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This is a primary election, so what is a Wisconsin voter going to see when they look at that ballot for the first time, both in terms of the races they'll see and candidates from which political parties?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a partisan primary is different than a general election in that you're voting for who you want to continue onto the general election ballot in November. And so in August, you're going to pick who are the people that you want to continue on to the big election in November. And so what it means to have a partisan primary, and in Wisconsin, we have what's called an open partisan primary, is you get to choose which party you'd like to vote in their primary, and you can only choose one. And so a voter, when they get their ballot, they're going to see that they have options for a lot of statewide races, congressional races, some county and local races that are partisan, and you're only going to be eligible to vote within one party's primary. If you cross over and vote in two parties' primary, that's what's called an overvote. And then your votes in that those contests on that ballot are not going to count. And so voters really need to pay attention to the instructions that are on the ballot and the instructions that come from your local municipal clerk to ensure that they are filling out their ballot correctly so that their vote will be counted within one of the party's primaries.
Let's talk a little bit about how they get that ballot. Of course, a lot of voters cast their votes in polling places on election day, but that's not the only option here. Can you first briefly walk us through the way that someone could do what's called in-person absentee ballot?
Absolutely. In-person absentee voting happens in the 2 weeks before an election or a primary. So in the 2 weeks prior to the election, you can find out where in-person absentee is offered in your community. You can actually go to myvote.wi.gov. And if your local municipality has hours and locations for in-person absentee, you may see them there, or you may see contact information for your local clerk where you can contact them and ask them where and when are they conducting in-person absentee. In larger communities, they'll often have much more broad hours and more locations where you can do that in-person absentee. In smaller communities like our towns, our many, many towns here in Wisconsin, your clerk may have in-person absentee by appointment, where you need to set up a time to meet with your town clerk to do in-person absentee voting. And so go to myvote.wi.gov and type in your address, and then you're going to see contact information for your local clerk or hours and locations in your community where you can engage with in-person absentee. But again, that happens in the 2 weeks prior to an election.
That website that you mentioned, the MyVote website, is also a way where you can request a ballot be sent to you that you can mail back. What are you advising people this time around when it comes to voting via the mail, given that there's greater concern about making sure that all of the requirements are met on a ballot and that the ballots are in the hands of election clerks at the time that they need to be counted?
So if you're going to vote by mail, the guidance is to return that ballot, if you're returning it by mail, at least 10 days before the election. And the more time you can allow yourself, the better chance that that ballot is going to make it back in time to be counted. Here in the state of Wisconsin, sometimes people are surprised to hear that our law says ballots must be received in the hands of your municipal clerk by 8 p.m. on election day in order to be counted. And so it's really important. We don't have laws like some other states where it can be postmarked by election day and then received later. It has to be back to your clerk by 8 p.m. on election day to be counted. And so it's really, really important that if you're returning your ballot by mail, get that back in the mail as soon as possible. Or if you're able to, you can explore other options like returning it in person to your municipal clerk, or if they have drop boxes in your community, calling your municipal clerk and finding out where those drop boxes are and what opportunities you have to return that in person to make sure your clerk has got it by election day in order to be counted. Another important thing about our law here in Wisconsin is once you've returned that ballot, so once you put it in the mail, once you give it back to your clerk, you are not able to spoil it and get another ballot, even if it doesn't arrive in time. So let's say you put your ballot in 5 days before the election and you go to myvote.wi.gov to see if your clerk received it back. If the clerk has not received it back by election day, but you've returned it, you're not going to be eligible to get a ballot at the polls on election day because you've already returned your ballot, even though it hasn't made it back in time. So it's really, really important that people try to get those ballots back as soon as possible to ensure it is back to your clerk by 8 p.m. on election day and that it can be counted.
So we've covered a range of ways that a person can cast a ballot and return that ballot to elections officials. How about a person who would like to vote but hasn't yet registered? What documentation, what's the process that they need to engage in to make that happen?
Also a great question. In the state of Wisconsin, you have a lot of options for registering to vote. So if we are more 20 days or more before an election, you have the option to register to vote on myvote.wi.gov. If you have a valid and current Wisconsin driver license and you're able to match all of your information for your voter record to the DMV, then you can actually register to vote online at myvote.wi.gov. You can also register to vote by mail more than 20 days before the election. As we get closer to the election, then you can also register to vote in your municipal clerk's office. So let's say you're doing in-person absentee. You'd be able to register to vote in your clerk's office before you do your in-person ballot. And then, of course, on election day here in the state of Wisconsin, you can register at your polling place for your new address at the polls on election day. When you register to vote, especially those in-person options, you're going to want to bring a couple of things with you. So you always have to have a photo ID that proves who you are. And that's just to get a ballot here in Wisconsin once you're registered. But to get registered, you also need to bring something called a proof of residence, which proves where you live, what your address is, what ballot you're eligible to get. And that can be something like a utility bill or a bank statement. It could even be your Wisconsin ID if your ID has your current address on it. And so as you're going to vote, make sure you've got that photo ID, something like a driver license, to prove who you are. And then if you need to register, if you've changed your name or if you've moved, then you're going to want to make sure you have a proof of residence document, something that proves where you live, like a utility bill or a bank statement.
We're talking with Megan Wolf, Administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, about what you need to know about Wisconsin's voting process ahead of the primary in August. Megan, you talked about security measures to make sure that the person who is in front of election staff is the person who's supposed to be casting a ballot. What kinds of other security measures are in place at polling places for both safety and election integrity?
Yeah, another great question. So for all voters in the state of Wisconsin, when you're registering to vote, you have to prove who you are. You have to prove where you live. So registration is the first step. You know, how do you get on the voter list? And that has a lot of security around it to ensure that only eligible voters, people that are 18 years of age, that are U.S. citizens, that have resided at their address for at least 28 days, all of those checks happen during the registration step before you can even be put on the voter rolls. Once you're registered and on the voter rolls, then to make your absentee ballot request or to receive a ballot in person, you again have to show your ID to prove who you are and that you're lawfully registered to vote. You also have to state your name and address publicly when you vote in person or when you vote by absentee ballot. Your name and address is also going to be announced at your polling place when your ballot's counted on election day. Then you also are going to need to sign the poll book when you go to vote in person. And again, all of these records are used to double check that a person is lawfully registered to vote, that they're eligible to vote, and to ensure that they get the right ballot. And also all of those artifacts are used after the election as audits and canvasses are conducted to ensure that only one vote counts per voter, and that only eligible voters have their ballot counted.
We've seen several cases recently of candidates who appear on the ballot. They qualified to be on the ballot, but they've since suspended their campaign. So what options, if any, do voters who may have cast ballots ahead of primary day for candidates who then drop out, what can they do if they say, okay, well, this candidate isn't really running anymore?
Yeah, so once a voter has returned their ballot, they're not able to spoil that ballot and be issued another one if they're voting by absentee. So once you've returned it, you have returned your ballot and you're not able to change your mind or change who you voted for. And so if a voter is thinking that they might not know yet who they want to vote for, who may remain in the primary contest, they may want to wait a little bit until some of that's resolved, because once you've made your decision, you're not able to change your mind.
Okay, so we talked about how people can register to vote. We talked about the different ways to cast a ballot and return a ballot. Now we move forward to election night. When all the ballots are in, the deadline passes to put those back in the hands of election staff. How quickly then do Wisconsinites expect to start to see the results of the primary election? And how does that happen?
Yeah, so Unlike other states, in Wisconsin, all the ballots have to be back by 8 p.m. to be counted. But another interesting thing about Wisconsin election law is our clerks actually can't even start to open the absentee ballots, process them, put them into the tabulators until the polls open on election day. And so that means our clerks really just have election day, which is a public process. Anybody can go observe the tabulation of votes in their local community or in communities around Wisconsin. But how long it takes depends on how many ballots there are that need to be counted. What does turnout look like? Those are all factors in how long it takes to process. Because election officials, they're always going to prioritize accuracy, integrity, security of counting those ballots over speed. They have to make sure they get it right. And so it will take as long as it takes to get the job done well.
Whenever there's talk about elections in the U.S. these days, there's also often talk about these proposals to change election laws and rules, like the U.S. Postal Service proposing changes that would require states like Wisconsin to provide the agency with voter lists. There have been calls to withdraw those proposals. But on a practical level, when the Elections Commission hears about an idea for a change like this, does that mean you and your colleagues have to start working on responses or contingency plans, or is it more a wait-and-see kind of scenario?
When there are proposals out there, of course, we have to pay attention to them to make sure that if they were to become law, that we're ready to implement them. But that hasn't happened here. We've seen so much litigation and challenges to some of those federal laws or executive orders that certainly they're not in place. And so as of right now, we're really just focused on running a great election, focused on our state election laws. And for voters, none of those changes that you may hear about at the federal level are actually in place. So they will not impact how you participate in the August primary here in Wisconsin.
Megan Wolf, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She spoke with host Brady Carlson about what voters need to know about the election process before the primary on August 11th.
And for a look at what the candidates have to say about the issues affecting Wisconsin, you can access WPR's voter guide online at WPR.org.
Coming up, the Port Washington Historical Society took on a project that is a window into the past, with volunteers digging through local newspapers from the 1800s.
They really showed a glimpse of the community. They gave us a real look into daily life.
A tour of the exhibit called Extra Extra Special Edition, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In 1898, the community of Port Washington had fewer than 4,000 residents. And yet, it had four newspapers, including two German-language newspapers.
Volunteers at the Port Washington Historical Society have spent more than a year combing through old copies of those and other newspapers through the decades, including the Star, the Port Pilot, the Herald, the Washington County Eagle, and the Zeitung, to name just a few.
They've compiled an exhibition of the newspapers and objects that represented the eras that they were published in. The exhibit is called Extra Extra Special Edition, The Newspapers of Port Washington. To learn what they discovered about media and their community's history, we welcome two people behind the exhibit. Jerry Zarin is business manager for the Port Washington Resource Center, which houses the city's historical society. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Jackie Olison is collections manager for the Port Washington Historical Society. Jackie, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Jackie, let's start with you. What compelled you to start combing through these old newspapers?
Well, when we started to unearth them, and they had evidently been passed and collected for maybe three decades, and got very curious about them, and we started to work with them, and then as we worked with them, we found that they really showed a
glimpse of the community back, you know, in the 1800s. And we physically have one that goes back to 1886. And then we have a number of them that are in the 1897, 1898. And what they did was they gave us a real look into daily life, because they not only talked about what was happening in the community, but it was interesting because the local news was more like a gossip kind of a thing. Hmm. But they also had national and they had international news. So I found that to be fascinating that in 1897, you know, they wrote about the war in Spain. Hmm. So,
and all done without the internet, you know, amazing that these people could get those connections.
Right, right. No internet, no cell phones, no modern technology. Jerry, you worked on this exhibit as well. What stood out to you from going through these old papers that go back to the 1800s?
Well, I didn't get into it quite as much as Jackie did, but what fascinated me was some of the advertising that they had. I mean, one example is Warner Brothers, which was a department store that started in, I think, 1867, somewhere in there. They had like two-story department store, which was a real feature. And we have hangers in our exhibit from Warner Brothers. I mean, those sort of connections to me just fascinated me too. And again, when you pick up the newspaper, you're supposed to just look at it. But all at once, you find yourself reading the article and really getting into it.
Jackie, for this exhibit, as Jerry alludes to there, you decide to pair these old newspapers with some of the artifacts from that era. Can you give some examples of objects that you used for the display?
Well, we pulled out items like Jerry found that we have an Allen Edmonds here in town. And so back in the, I'm guessing like the early 2000s and later, they had, we had a pair of shoes, and Allen Edmonds would advertise in the newspaper. You had the grocery stores, you had Wilkie's was a merchandise store, and people, you know, shopkeepers back then would give away souvenirs. And so we ended up with a lot of these souvenirs that they had. So it was a great chance for us to pull out from our collections, you know, items that would have been advertised in the newspaper. And it was another aspect of, you know, common life back then.
And when you say Allen Edmonds was a shoe corporation, is that right?
Yes, and it still is. It still is. High-end shoes. So we had the metal Allen Edmonds name. And the shoes probably go back a little earlier, Jackie, because it's almost a pointed toe. They're white high heels with red, blue, yellow leather, all, I mean, gorgeously done.
Hmm. I remember wearing pointed shoes. You're right. Probably the 80s and the 90s. Yes.
And then the neat thing that Jackie really dug for this, because I found the picture of the Zausch brothers that made the cigar factory. And Jackie knew that we had a wooden cigar box, and in amongst the collection she was able to find that. So we also have that on exhibit, the picture of the old Zausch brothers themselves and then the cigar box.
How prominent were these advertisements in the newspapers that you looked at from, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s? What is that mix between the articles and the advertisements, Jackie?
Well, you know, it's interesting because some of the newspapers had those ads right on the front page. Mm-hmm. And then other newspapers, they were buried more, you know, into the newspaper. So it kind of depended on, there were really four prominent newspapers from the 1800s up to, one dropped off in the 30s, and then the rest continued. eventually got all bought out until now we just have the Ozaukee Press, which started in 1940. So those, you know, those ads then reflected the businesses. And as some of those businesses morphed into other, you know, businesses, then, but I think the fascinating part was, as Jerry alluded to, was some of the costs. I mean, a man could buy a suit, you know, in the 20s for $15. Hmm. And like a subscription to the newspaper was only $1.50 for the whole year. So it was fascinating, you know, to discover some of those types of things, you know, when we look through the papers.
Do you relate to another time, you know, mm-hmm. put yourself in that era, as you said, buying those things, eggs were, I mean, some of the ads, we just all laugh. I mean, the can of vegetables is 5 cents. I mean, it's just ridiculous, but at that time, it probably was expensive.
Yeah. We're talking about an exhibit of the newspapers that existed throughout Port Washington's history. Jackie Olison is collections manager for the Port Washington Historical Society. Jerry Zarin is business manager for the Port Washington Resource Center. There are also, in these collections of old newspapers, some German language newspapers. What can you tell us there about Port Washington and having German papers?
Well, they ended up, they had actually two German newspapers. They had the Port Washington Herald and they had the Zeitung. And we have issues of both. The Herald was kind of interesting because it was all in written in German up until World War One. And then World War One, by 1919, they had switched to being written just in English. And if you go back even further, there was a newspaper back that was called the Der Adler. And what was fascinating about that one, it was written in English on one side and it was German on the other side. So it appealed, I think, to both parts of the population. And we had a lot of German settlers, you know, that came into the community. We have a large Luxembourg population. And I think the newspapers reflected those. So when we looked at them, you know, we have one gal, one of our volunteers knows a little bit of German. And so she was able to go through and figure a little bit. But then we also were able to pick up the ads. And so then she translated a bunch of the ads for us so that we could go through and, you know, see, I mean, everything from doctors to, you know, grocery stores to carpenters would, you know, advertise in these newspapers. So, but it's interesting because by the time World War One had ended, everything was basically English speaking. And I think that reflected the times because people didn't want to be reminded, you know, about World War One. Mm-hmm. Anyways.
Jerry, can you get a sense of how valuable these newspapers were to the local Port Washington community as you go through the eras and as you look at these papers, how they connected to the residents?
It must have been a very, very strong connection. I mean, I'm very proud of those citizens of those days that they made the effort to purchase and read a newspaper when they could have very easily tucked their head under their shoulder wing and thought that the world would go on. But I think the fact that they were so hungry for news reflects so well on the citizens. And the fact that Port Washington and Washington County, you know, had an ongoing fight about who was going to be the county seat. So I think that also politically motivated a lot of the newspapers. So I just think it's amazing. And I'm looking back at thinking of our era now, where our newspapers are all going out, and I'm thinking, no, you know, they're important to the world.
Jerry, what's been the response to the exhibit so far? What have you heard?
Well, the people that come in, they're kind of in awe about it, I guess. They kind of like, oh, really? It went back that far? And, of course, they like to see the old newspapers. And if they're Port Washingtonites, they can connect with a lot of the things that we have in the exhibit. Oh, I remember that type of thing, you know, and it does bring a chuckle to you. So I'd say it's been well received.
Jackie, as you mentioned today, Port Washington only has one local newspaper, the Ozaukee Press. Are you worried about the changing media environment in Port Washington?
Well, I think some of us that are older probably worry a little bit more about a local paper going out of business. And maybe that younger group, I mean, I'm amazed sometimes when I talk to people that they don't know what's going on in port. And I'll say, well, you don't get the press. No, I don't. Well, I mean, that's kind of telling in the direction that we're going. So I guess those of us that are older, and I think Jerry would voice the same concern is, you know, where do we go eventually?
What will happen with the newspaper archives after this exhibit closes?
They will go back. They're like most of our stuff that we put on exhibit. They will go back into storage, and we keep, you know, we keep basically the framework of that whole exhibit, and we'll bring it back out again. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had about every 2 years or so, we have a new exhibit, and the items are coming out of our collections. They go back into storage, but we hang on to the poster boards and everything, and we will remake it some way and bring it out again.
At a future date, yes.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Jerry and Jackie, thank you so much for joining us.
It's our pleasure, at least my pleasure. And again, if that helps promote newspapers, oh, it's a blessing.
Yeah. We're so glad that you approached us and allowed us to give voice to what we're doing here in Port Washington. And we really encourage people to come to port and check us out. You know, so thank you so much for doing this.
That is Jackie Olison, Collections Manager for the Port Washington Historical Society, and Jerry Zarin, the Business Manager for the Port Washington Resource Center. They were with us to share a new exhibit in Port Washington that is chronicling the history of all the newspapers in their community going back to the 1800s. The exhibit called Extra Extra Special Edition, The Newspapers of Port Washington, can be viewed at the community's resource center. It will be on display through May. My mom, she hung on to Life magazines from the 1960s. And as I leafed through them, things, you know, come up. You notice things. Have you looked back at old newspapers and magazines, maybe in your community? What do they tell you? What do you notice? Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up next week on the show, we'll look at water safety and swimming instruction efforts around the state that aim to keep kids safe in the state's lakes, rivers, and pools.
And we want to hear from you. Parents, was it important for you to get swimming lessons for your kids at an early age? And were you able to find those kinds of lessons in your part of the state?
And how about the lifeguards out there? If you've worked as a lifeguard at a pool or a beach, tell us the story of how you got into that. Same goes for swimming instructors.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call and leave a message or send us a text. That number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Beatrice Lawrence, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.